Thank you, Paul, and thank you to the Society for this very kind invitation to address you all. Maybe some of you can relate to this. I'm at that critical point in my physical decline where I need glasses to look at my notes. I was hoping I'd be able to get away with this, but I can see I'm going to have to put the glasses on. And it's always dangerous to ask an academic to talk for 20 minutes. You know, we're programmed to talk for 50 minutes. I would also like to have perhaps some sort of a test after this, if we could arrange that. A quiz or something would make me feel better. But so while the impact of the positivism August Comte on some American intellectuals has often been noted in kind of vague terms, I've argued that American Comtists were significant participants in what some have called the reconstruction of American liberalism that occurred in the late 19th century and the early 20th century. Before the close of the century, Comtean influences were well established in some American circles. In the writings of amateur social theorist Lester Frank Ward, often known as the father of American sociology, academic sociologist E.A. Ross, and the journalist Herbert Crowley, that I'm going to be looking at most today, one recognizes Comtean categories and assumptions at work, making a significant contribution, I would argue, to progressive thought. Indeed, Comtean positivism helped direct the development of a new liberal discourse by the early 20th century, reshaping American liberalism in some important ways. For many, it encouraged an interventionist bent, a confidence in the ability to reform. For most, it fostered a faith in technocratic elites. And in general, it nurtured a statist or a corporatist bent within American liberalism that continues to play a central role in the nation's political discourse. Therefore, by the time of the First World War, the character and the shape of the new liberalism owed more to the Comtean tradition than many scholars have previously recognized. But, as I say, I'd like to look, since I've only got limited time here, at Crowley. I want to focus on the thought of the New Republic's founding editor, Herbert Crowley, also mentioning a few others along the way here. Most scholars, with the exception of Crowley's biographer, David Levy, who wrote a really excellent biography of Crowley a few decades ago, have downplayed the long-term influence of Orthodox positivism on Crowley. But I'd argue that Crowley's Comtism is perhaps the best way to understand his often impenetrable, or at the very least, difficult thought. Moreover, it was through Lester Ward and through Crowley that American progressivism was able to draw directly upon Comtean social thought. By way of these two key thinkers, the transformation of American liberalism received its most significant Comtean contribution. Now, Herbert Crowley was born into a remarkable family. The influence of his father, David Crowley, was undeniably profound. David Crowley, the elder Crowley, was a New York newspaper man of Irish extraction, a very conservative Democrat, was a city editor for the New York World for many years. But strangely, he became leader of the city's small circle of Comte devotees in the 1860s and 1870s. Together, Herbert Crowley's parents, this is in Eric Goldman's words, turned their home into the country's best-known salon of positivism. Though neither the first nor probably the last American child to receive this distinction, Herbert Crowley was actually baptized into Comte's religion of humanity. Someone once described Comte's religion of humanity, I think it's a good description, as Catholicism minus theology. How's that for a sort of a Zen definition there, Catholicism minus theology. Sounding still embarrassed by his parents' participation in this admittedly very fringe group, Herbert Crowley later reflected as an adult that his baptism, quote, may not be an important educational birthmark, but ill-favored as it is unmistakably mine own. Well, after resignation as editor of the New York Daily Graphic in 1878, until his death in 1889, David Crowley, Herbert's father, lavished attention on his son. As an adult, Herbert Crowley attributed his interest in the world of ideas to his father. Quote, he was himself a running brook of ideas, the younger Crowley remembered. On every subject in which a citizen of the world ought to be interested, he literally poured a part of this flood into my little mental receptacles without noticing or caring how much of it overflowed. In his memoirs, Crowley recalled the lofty tone of his father's didactic monologues. He talks about walking in Central Park and having his dad just sort of monologue for hours. Words such as humanity, progress, social aspiration, and the like impressed Crowley as a boy, and their power endured as he matured. Quote, unless I'm very much mistaken, he observed later, my regular immersion in this shower of humanitarian ideas and aspirations was the most important single influence in my education, end quote. My father, again quoting here from Crowley later in life, my father proclaimed an allegiance to Auguste Comte and his religion of humanity. Herbert Crowley remembered his father's Comteism as, quote, a philosophy which was also a religion. It seemed to him that, here I'm quoting, Comte was trying, like so many other thinkers of the early 19th century, to envisage the conversion of scientific truth into steady progress in the arts of secular life. But, unlike his contemporaries, he considered that the new liberated society, no less than the old, would need authoritative religious conviction and guidance. Thus, far from being a sterile rationalist, Herbert Crowley described his father as having, quote, all the ardor and elan of a religious convert. He convinced Herbert of, quote, the impossibility of carrying out the work of human emancipation without a religious clue or a religious fortification. The positivism of his father did not, therefore, leave Crowley with a kind of closed scientific determinism, as indoctrination in, say, Herbert Spencer's positivism might have done. Herbert Crowley's Comteism exhibited a robust faith in man as an active agent, using positive science to improve his environment. Like Lester Ward before him, Crowley found a meliorism in Comte that differed from much of the scientistic determinism of his age. Here, Crowley said, was, quote, the point of departure of all my future work. I think that's a very significant admission, the point of departure of all my future work, and as I said, often overlooked by scholars of progressivism. In 1886, the 17-year-old Crowley enrolled in Harvard as a freshman. Crowley attended classes at Harvard off and on for the following 11 years. In fact, he didn't receive his bachelor's degree until he got an honorary degree from Harvard in 1910, and that was because of the recent publication of The Promise of American Life. I'll be talking about that book in a minute. Though his studies were frequently interrupted, obviously, Harvard had a profound influence on the young New Yorker. Crowley found an altruistic elitism and a pragmatic scientism at Harvard that was quite congenial with his father's idea of a positive priesthood, of this sort of, you know, intellectually trained elite. Now, the young Crowley concentrated in philosophy with fully half of his 26 courses taken between 1886 and 1897 being in either philosophy or religion. The Harvard philosophers at the time, especially William James, of course, didn't take the approach that Auguste Comte did. They were developing ideas based on the German philosopher Immanuel Kant and Kantian idealism. That was how they resolved the conflict between science and religion that had dominated the 1870s and 80s. And Comte hadn't taken that route, and so a number of historians have said, oh, well, you know, he went to Harvard, he was immersed in this German idealism, and he forgot about Comte. But I think that's wrong. It would be easy to overdraw the threat that Harvard philosophy posed to Herbert Crowley's Comtean, you know, earlier childhood indoctrination. Crowley himself conceded that, quote, before long I ceased to find my own revolt against positivism, you know, as a college kid, entirely convincing. As a matter of fact, he observed, I soon abandoned what he called Hegelianism. Crowley described this return to a philosophical position much closer to that of his father's as altogether, quote, natural. Indeed, he lamented soon after his father's death that it was unfortunate that his dad had, quote, exaggerated the differences between us. All right, well, leaving Harvard in 1893, Crowley entered the working world at a time when American society was undergoing rapid change. An urban, middle-class, and diverse reform movement that historians have labeled progressivism was just beginning. It was with this latter movement that Crowley soon identified, naturally so, though he would also prove to be one of its most incisive critics. Political scientist Jeffrey Lustig has referred to what he calls the positivism of the progressives. That's in a book he wrote back in the 1980s. And I think the case of Herbert Croly can help us clarify in what meaningful ways were these progressives positivists. Now, not unlike Comte in the early 19th century France, progressives in America in the 1890s or turn of the century were concerned about social instability caused by the rapid advance of capitalism and the persistence of what they considered to be outdated, formalistic social theories and political theory. This progressive concern was, in some respects, therefore, a reincarnation, you could say, of Comte's animating interest to resolve the conflict of order and progress. Remember, that was what Comte thought he was up to in his system, that he was resolving the conflict of order and progress. The Comtean answer, furnished by many progressives, was organization on a national scale. Progressives hoped to build modern national institutions on a harmonious national community. Another feature that many progressives shared with positivists was an elitist perspective. Government bureaucracy, just like the utopian reformer Edward Bellamy's industrial army, and maybe you've read the book Looking Backward, was a hierarchical structure, though it was hoped it would be a meritocracy. Progressivism's characteristic emphasis upon executive authority was also sometimes turned in an explicitly elitist direction. Furthermore, progressives conceived of the scientific expert in terms very similar to Comte's description of a positive priesthood, and virtually identical to the earlier fellow I mentioned earlier, Lester Frank Ward's vision of a civil service technocracy. Yet we should remember here that progressives, in the historian Robert Wiebe's words, quote, believed they were only modernizing, not destroying democracy. Several of the key components of the progressive system, as Wiebe puts it, the philosopher kings, the rational public, the social consensus, all of these were strongly reminiscent of Lester Ward's work and, I would say earlier, the position of Auguste Comte. So, elements of progressive thought, I would argue, dovetail neatly with positivism. But how, in his mature work, did Herbert Croly creatively apply Comte to early 20th century American conditions? To that, we need to turn to The Promise of American Life, his most important book, his first major book published in 1909. It really establishes Croly's reputation as an astute social commentator and a political analyst. Remember that the phrase, the new nationalism, that T.R. uses in the 1912 campaign comes from that book. He was profoundly affected by it. They exchanged letters over it. Although it wasn't really a popular success, the book attracted the attention not only of Roosevelt, but also landed Croly the job of editing The New Republic, founded in 1914 with the financial support of Willard Strait. Croly's political theory was founded, as Comte had been, on a thoroughgoing critique of classical economics and Enlightenment liberalism. The contractual constitutional limits that 18th century theorists imposed were especially odious to Croly. Nations could not be limited by such strictures. Every popular government, Croly declared in The Promise of American Life, should in the end, and after a necessarily prolonged deliberation, possess the power of taking any action which, in the opinion of a decisive majority of the people, is demanded by the public welfare. Such is not the case with the government organized under the federal constitution, he wrote. To correct the United States, what he called its erroneous democratic theory, and address its current problems, Croly proposed a spirit of democratic nationalism as, quote, the road whereby alone the American people can obtain political salvation. For Croly, a nation was defined both by its habits and traditions of historical association, which constitute an indispensable bond, and by its loyalty to a particular formative political idea. In the case of the American nation, that central political idea was democracy. Croly hoped that by joining political democracy with a strong sense of nationalism, he could forge a powerful instrument to secure American greatness. Devotion to democratic politics was not enough by itself, however. democracy was dependent on community, and vice versa. Too often in the past, these twin principles had been viewed as necessarily in conflict, but Crowley argued that the one could not be fully realized without the other. The less confidence the American people have in a national organization, the less they are willing to surrender themselves to the national spirit, the worse Democrats they will be. Small d there. Right, Crowley's method in much of The Promise of American Life, as well as in his later book, and his later book is definitely different and strikes a different kind of tone. It's called Progressive Democracy. But his method in both books is very historical. Nearly a quarter of the first book was made up of Crowley's survey of the American past, and much of the remainder of the book dealt with current problems, but dealt with them historically. The Promise, in particular, was, as Byron Dexter has called it, quote, a theoretical answer in American terms to the question of what happened to America, end quote. It was through an understanding of the nation's history, said Crowley, that Crowley hoped to construct that theoretical answer. Crowley began with the ideological debate that emerged in Washington's first cabinet between Hamilton and Jefferson. This argument between Hamiltonian activism on the one hand and Hamiltonian nationalism and Jeffersonian laissez-faire and state particularism on the other hand had characterized American political discourse from its inception. The Jeffersonians and their descendants had, however, usually prevailed. Thus, Jacksonian Democrats showed their ideological lineage by their war on the Second Bank and by their other negative policies. Only the Civil War, Crowley believed, quote, began to emancipate the American national idea from an obscurantist individualism and provincialism, end quote. Then, in the post-Civil War era, the development of the nation's economy demonstrated clearly the contradictions, Crowley believed, within the Jeffersonian / Jacksonian school. The rise of big business made apparent to most, Crowley wrote, that, quote, the two primary interests of American life, the interest of the individual businessman and the interest of the body politic, could not substantially coincide. Having sketched the historical roots of the modern American dilemma, Crowley then goes on in The Promise to chastise his fellow countrymen for not having reassessed their abstract political principles in light of actual history. The truth is, said Crowley, that Americans have not readjusted their political ideas to the teaching of their political and economic experience. At first, the contradictions inherent in the Jeffersonian Equal Rights School were not readily apparent. But as society developed, the demands of the higher law began to diverge from the actual results of the legal system. Better students of history could recognize, quote, with the advent of comparative economic and social maturity, the exercise of certain legal rights became substantially equivalent to the exercise of privilege. Study of such Enlightenment ideas in their historical context demonstrated to Crowley their serious limitations, indeed their danger if applied uncritically to present circumstances. Quote, belief in the principles of equal rights does not bind, heal, and unify public opinion, he wrote. Its effect rather is confusing, distracting, and at worst, disintegrating. Crowley's social and political theory was also statist and interventionist. Crowley asserted that the national public interest has to be affirmed by positive and aggressive action. Again, the logical vehicle to spearhead such action was the state. Here, the question for Crowley was not whether such interventionism violated certain abstract principles, but rather whether it worked. Objections about the selectivity of such intervention were, he believed, illegitimate. The practice of non-interference, argued Crowley, is just as selective in its effects as the practice of state interference. Therefore, Crowley's theory of the state was mostly, as I said, historical and pragmatic. Indeed, The Promise of American Life, in The Promise, in this book, he spent nearly 50 pages describing the origins and the growth of the nation-state in Europe from the Dark Ages to the present. Crowley's view of the role of social science in a progressive society with its typical Comtean emphasis on a technocratic elite was mirrored in his discussion of industrial and governmental leadership in America. Crowley, and this is interesting, Crowley disassociated himself from those progressives who saw the giant trusts as inherently evil. as well as from those who viewed affluent entrepreneurs as a uniformly malevolent lot. As he reflected in one revealing point in The Promise, quote, "I am far from believing that this concentration of economic power is wholly an undesirable thing. I'm also far from believing that the men in whose hands this power is concentrated deserve, on the whole, any exceptional moral reprobation for the manner in which it has been used. In certain respects, they have served their country well," end quote. Crowley then continues the Comtean tradition's approval of the captains of industry. As long as the underlying principle, the subordination of the individual to the demand of a dominant and constructive national purpose, as long as that was understood, these elites needed, therefore, to be given national direction, not, thought Crowley, popular censure. I'm reminded here of Theodore Roosevelt's intervention in the anthracite coal strike, where he, you know, he's very angry about private interests not recognizing executive direction. You know, he doesn't want to really recognize the union, but he also wants the owners of the coal of the mines to recognize federal government supremacy. I trust this analysis confirms that the Comtean element explains well the peculiar texture of Herbert Crowley's social thought. His system is strange, it's confusing, it's certainly a hybrid in some respects, a more complex and creative hybrid than, say, Lester Frank Ward's social thought, but I would say an unmistakably Comtean mixture or amalgam nonetheless. Well, to wrap this up, what do I say in conclusion? The departure of American political theory from the negative state liberalism of Jacksonian democracy can be attributed in part, I would say, to the interventionist impulse of American Comtists like Lester Ward and others. I've focused here, of course, mostly on Herbert Crowley. Of course, before Herbert Crowley, the antebellum Whigs had envisaged a positive liberal state, but Comte provided compelling arguments in the new language of social science. The positivism of thinkers such as Lester Ward joined then these two traditions, the antebellum Whig tradition, the native tradition, if you will, and the foreign element, while Herbert Crowley cemented this union with the progressive movement. Another key element of the new liberalism that was being forged in the first years of the 20th century was pluralistic or corporatist. Many progressives saw groups and not individuals as society's main building blocks. Here again, I would say the Comtean contribution was critical. Abstract individual rights, remember, had been rejected by Comte and by much of early sociology in favor of duties that arose naturally and historically from social groupings. And so one can see that kind of corporatist or pluralist approach in the writings of Crowley. All right, to conclude then, the liberalism that emerged in the early 20th century clearly owed, I would argue, much to Comtean thought. Reformers of various kinds saw Comtean ideas as an effective antidote against the strictures of laissez-faire liberalism in its classical or in its newer Spencerian form, you know, following the positivism of Herbert Spencer. From Theodore Roosevelt's New Nationalism to the New Deal to the Great Society, elite-led reform has often prevailed over alternative models that conceived a political or economic reformation as perhaps better a more localized, participatory, or grassroots affair. While some progressives understood that 19th century liberalism and individualism was changed by the new economic order, their revised liberalism failed to promote the genuine community of a democratic commonwealth, and they built instead on the solidarity of the private corporation. Participatory or egalitarian alternatives to this sort of corporate liberalism have received little popular consideration in national politics in recent decades, and since many critics of big government continue to overlook the threat to authentic community and to the commonweal represented by its main ally, big business, it seems unlikely that the misstep taken by American liberalism at the turn of the century will be corrected very soon. Thank you.